When we think of the United States of America, what is the first image that pops into our minds? For some, it's open countryside and rural villages dotting the various terrains across the country, a symbol of agriculture and fruitful endeavors. For others, it's trekking across mountains and hillsides, scavenging the westward deserts on an adventure to pursue the ultimate dream. For many, however, America can be best symbolized by its most bustling and populated metropolis, New York City. While the concrete jungle is void of green foliage or the natural landscape seen across the United States, it still houses the dreamers who chase those same goals. NYC is the focal point for artists and engineers and workers across all sectors to come together to fight for their innermost desires, a place where creativity and commerce thrive in synchrony. It's a haven for anyone looking to escape, while at the same time network and develop a relationship with not just other people, but with an entire city as well. That's the kind of open arms the Big Apple is known for. New York's history is as vast as its diverse population as well. Originally a Dutch fur trading settlement known as New Amsterdam, dating back to 1625, New York was eventually given to the English troops in 1664, before becoming the province of New York, and one of the original 13 colonies to fight for their independence from monarch rule in 1775. By 1790, it held the highest population in all of America, a record that would go unchanging over the next 230 plus years. Throughout the 19th century, New York City became an international icon, the hub for both national and international trading in the United States, as well as the hotspot for European immigration into America. These developments combined with the booming economy entering and exiting its harbor every day, pushing New York City well on its way to defining the success of the USA by the 20th century, and remains to be true to present day. With roots dating back to colonial times and a centuries-long pattern of hosting millions upon millions of people, New York City is not without its paranormal side either. No city on earth with such a rich history like New York has functioned without a darker underbelly, with stories full of supernatural entities and creepy characters lurking in dark subway tunnels or shadows of a fog-filled alley near the port. They may not be what defines New York City, nor may they be the most documented aspects of its history, but one thing's for sure, there's more than one reason why they call it the city that never sleeps. Let's take a deeper dive into a few of the notable and a few of the lesser-known cases of the ghosts of New York City. The Curse of Aaron Burr. The first thing you think of when you hear the name Aaron Burr surely isn't ghosts. It's probably more aligned with the Revolutionary War, or his vice presidency with Thomas Jefferson, or his infamous duel with Alexander Hamilton, or even the smash hit Broadway musical named after his arch rival. What's inarguable about Burr is his uncanny ability to run into trouble wherever he went, usually by his own misdoings, and leaving behind a legacy of injustice and ruin. Along with the way Burr left his mark amongst many New York scenes, and whether by sheer coincidence or by the energy he conjured within him, so did a series of ghosts and other spiritually haunted handprints. The first such ghost sighting related to Aaron Burr came at 17 Barrow Street, a residence located between 7th Avenue South and West 4th Street in Manhattan, New York. Originally built in 1767 as a carriage house, a structure that protected carriages and horse carts, it was purchased by Burr in 1794. At the time, Burr was told a ghost haunted the structure, but Burr shook off the warnings and turned it into living quarters. Over the next decade, Burr found himself in all sorts of predicaments and ended up moving to Europe before returning to New York years later. The old carriage house turned residence, having been sold to new owners. By the 1830s, it was turned into a brothel and pub combination, yet the ghost stories continued. In 1910, the pub became an official restaurant, renamed to 1 if by land, 2 if by sea. It was at this newly established restaurant where the ghost sightings hit their peak, Both workers and customers alike reported seeing Aaron Burr's ghost hiding in storage closets and hanging around the dining room during slow periods. In addition to Burr, the ghost of his daughter, Theodosia Burr Alston, has been spotted from time to time. When the Burr family spirits aren't around, diners have also claimed to have seen the ghost of Ziegfeld Foley showgirls from the 1930s, popular guests when the restaurant first opened in the early 20th century. For the most part, the spirits left at 1 if by land, 2 if by sea have been harmless. Sans a poltergeist-like ghoul that reportedly made a waitress quit because she kept getting pushed down the stairs on multiple occasions when no one else was around. The second spiritual scenario involving Aaron Burr was born in the waning days of 1799, when Guglielma Alma Sands disappeared on December 22nd in New York City. Alma had recently encountered a courtship with a 23-year-old man by the name of Levi Weeks, and the two were reportedly planning to be married in secret that night. According to Alma's cousin, Catherine, Levi was a skilled carpenter employed by his brother, Ezra Weeks, an ultra-successful builder in the Big Apple, known for constructing some of the finest mansions across the city. Alma had lived in a boarding house at the time, and her peers were quick to note her disappearance. They reported her missing to the authorities the following day, and the police investigated for clues around the city. A couple of days later, they found some of Alma's belongings near the Manhattan Well, in Lispendard Meadows, which had recently been built close to the intersection of Spring Street and Green Street, in what is now modern-day Soho. Right after the new year, on January 2nd, 1800, authorities returned to the Manhattan Well and recovered Alma's body from the bottom of the cylinder. Her neck appeared to be broken before her last breath was taken, and the cause of death was quickly ruled a homicide, and the hunt for her killer ensued. It didn't take long for Levi Weeks to be considered the sole suspect in the case, seeing as though he was the last person witnesses saw with Alma alive. Because of Levi's connections and his brother's wealth, he was able to hire a team of premier lawyers to defend him. The lawyers in question, no other than attorney heavyweights, Henry Brockenholz Livingston, future Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, Alexander Hamilton, founder of the United States financial system, and Secretary of Treasury, and Aaron Burr, Hamilton's longtime legal rival and future killer, as well as future Vice President of the United States. The official trial took place on March 31st and April 1st later that year. After the prosecution, led by future mayor of New York City, Cadwallader David Colden, found their key witnesses and pieces of evidence. In what seemed to be the most revolutionary testimony, one of the prosecutor's witnesses claimed to have seen Levi measuring the Manhattan Well on Sunday, December 15th, a week before the murder took place. Another witness said that Levi had impregnated Alma and was uninterested in fathering their future child. Everything seemed to be going against Levi Weeks, but in the end, Hamilton and Burr's legal precision was too much for the prosecution to overcome. After a mere 5-minute deliberation, the jury found Levi Weeks not guilty on all charges, and he was left a free man. The court case entered the pop culture lexicon immediately, as it provided the oldest official transcript for any court case in the United States history. It also became a defining moment in Aaron Burr's career as a lawyer, as he flaunted the victory the rest of his life. In regards to Levi Weeks, he soon moved away from the city after the citizens of New York lambasted him with disgust at the trial's outcome. Everyone believed him to be guilty, and that he was getting away with first-degree murder. Starting a new life in Natchez, Mississippi, Levi successfully escaped the shadow of the Manhattan Well murder and raised a family of his own before passing away peacefully in 1819. The spirit of Alma Sands was not so fortunate. In 1817, the Manhattan Well was filled with cement and built over, hidden within newfound construction and becoming a forgotten relic of colonial New York. In 1820, 129 Spring Street, the building where the well was concealed in the basement, became a remedy shop for those recovering from tobacco addictions. This store was then replaced by a brewery later in the 19th century, before becoming vacant for decades to come. Over 160 years passed since the Manhattan Well was buried before it was rediscovered in 1980. when 129 Spring Street became extra storage for a restaurant called Manhattan Bistro. The bistro needed the building's spacious cellar and excavated it, thus uncovering the well. From the get-go, the well made the restaurant staff feel uneasy and creeped out workers when they were down in the cellar during nighttime hours. Eventually, the bistro sold the building to retailers, and 129 Spring Street is now a H&M clothing store. The Manhattan well still in pristine condition downstairs. Since her body was found in 1800, countless passerby at Green and Spring Streets have claimed to hear a woman's scream emanate from 129, as if the woman was pleading for her life. It's thought that these screams belong to the ghost of Alma, because her figure has been seen as an apparition floating around the intersection and throughout the building, and had her soul been stuck at the bottom of the well, it could have mirrored her real-life pleas for help. The young lady crying just as she was murdered and her body discarded. A bulk of the horror stories related to the Manhattan Well have come in the years since the structure was switched to a clothing shop. Managers at H&M claim they lose merchandise on a weekly basis, much more than what is normal for basic inventory losses. They also report more elevator outages and electrical shortages than most businesses in the district, and when maintenance inspects the malfunctions, they find nothing structurally wrong with the elevators. Without a mechanical explanation, the workers believe it's due to Alma's disturbed spirit. The worst of all the Manhattan Well hauntings comes from a report that after Levi Weeks was found not guilty, and Alma was laid to rest without ever receiving justice. Her cousin Catherine returned to 129 Spring Street and laid a curse on the well, asking the Almighty to curse everyone involved in the trial for eternity. As a result, 30 years later, the presiding judge who swung the final gavel, New York Supreme Court Chief Justice John Lansing Jr., disappeared at 75 years old. He had left his hotel in Manhattan to venture to the post office and mail a letter but never returned. Most people think he was kidnapped and murdered by political rivals, but those aware of his role in the Alma Sands murder trial believe John was cursed by Catherine. They go as far to say John was hypnotized by the ghost of Alma, who brought Jack back to the Manhattan Well and instructed him to climb inside. Then, when he fell to the bottom, it opened up, and John was pulled into the depths of hell by Alma, his eternal punishment for letting a guilty man walk free and leave Alma's memory at the base of the Manhattan Well. The third and final spiritual scenario with Aaron Burr at the forefront came after his return to New York City in 1812. Burr had fled the country and settled in Europe after his infamous duel with Alexander Hamilton turned sour and he became a hated man. Back in the Big Apple, Burr changed his surname to Edwards to avoid public detection and reopened his law practice. Years later, on July 1, 1833, Burr married New York City socialite Eliza Jummel, who was 19 years younger, but withholding a hefty fortune. The fortune in question came from Eliza's first husband, Stephen Jummel. Jummel had purchased the Morris House back in 1810 with his own massive wealth. The Morris House was built by Roger Morris in 1765, but was confiscated by the colony of New York when Roger and his wife were outed as English loyalists. It was then used as a command post by General George Washington during the Revolutionary War, and subsequently turned into a farmhouse tavern when the Treaty of Paris was signed in 1783. After Stephen and Eliza moved in is when the trouble began. Witnesses observed the couple engaging in countless arguments, and many felt Eliza was only courting the marriage to enjoy the spoils of Stephen's riches. In 1816, after a year of living in France, Eliza returned to Mount Morris, now known as the Morris Jummel Mansion, to correct the financial shortcomings the couple had endured whilst abroad. Eliza was able to save the Jummel fortune, much to the behest of Stephen, and the two remained a couple until Stephen's battle with pneumonia ended in 1832. Left with Stephen's estate and an art collection she amassed over the years to trips to Europe, Eliza was sitting pretty as a respected upperclassman of New York City. Not everyone saw Eliza as an innocent benefactor of the Jummel fortune, however. Some believe Eliza had a role in the death of her husband, theorizing she had let the pneumonia run its course rather than seek the appropriate treatment needed to save Stephen's life. It was never proven, but often discussed within gossip chains around Manhattan. These rumours caught fire again in 1833 when Eliza married Aaron Burr, seemingly to boost her status once more, and divorced him only months later when he mismanaged her liquid assets. In her later years, Eliza kept mostly to her rooms within the Morris Jamal Mansion at 65 Jamal Terrace in Roger Morris Park. She lived there up until her death in 1865. As friends and family discussed for the last few years, Eliza's growing mental instability and borderline insanity, it's these stories of Eliza's struggles that bled into her legacy, with reports of ghosts and spirits lingering in the Morris Jamal Mansion, haunting its visitors. Specifically, people have claimed to see Eliza Jamal's apparition hanging around the rooms of her former residence, screaming at noisy school children when they visit on field trips. Some wonder if Eliza's ghost remains in distress due to the guilt she faced for the rumours around Stephen Jamal's death. Others believe her spirit was never put to rest simply due to the gossip she endured. Regardless, the supernatural tension and eerie vibrations felt at Mount Morris certainly led one to believe the paranormal has put a stake in its ground, cementing Aaron Burr's legacy as more than just a historical figure, but as a cursed harbourer of ghosts and disturbed spirits that haunt colonial New York all the way through present day. St. Paul's Chapel. Almost a decade before the American Revolution kicked off in Lexington and Concord, a small Episcopal parish of the Trinity Church erected a building known as St. Paul's Chapel at 209 Broadway. It was one of New York City's greatest models of late Georgian architecture, the tallest building in the city at the time, and a beloved icon by New Yorkers and tourists alike. Before it was a National Historic Landmark, however, the property where St. Paul's Chapel was located had a longer, darker history. Next to the building was a graveyard with tombstones dating back as far as 1697, whose occupants were rumored to come out at night and linger around the area. One of those unlucky souls was an 18th century man by the name of George Frederick Cook, an actor, notorious gambler, an otherwise erratic personality. Between acting gigs, Cook was quick to lose bets, but always seemed to stay afloat long enough to make it to the next card game or chicken fight. Near the end of his life, Cook fell victim to the alcoholism he had suffered since entering adulthood, and his unpredictable behavior hit its apex. One night, his gambling luck hit an all-time low, and Cook lost almost all of the fortune he had amassed during his lucrative acting career. Knowing his time had come, Cook arranged with biological researchers that when he would officially die, he'd be decapitated and his head would be sold in the name of science. The researchers stayed true to their word, and when Cook finally met his demise, he was beheaded and buried amidst the other lonely bodies dwelling at the St. Paul's Cemetery. In the years that followed, visitors at the chapel and adjacent graveyard would speak of sightings they made of a headless man wandering around the property. Near the chapel was an abandoned alleyway where a theatre used to reside. It's theorized that Cook's spirit could never truly give up his acting career and would roam the alleys in hopes of landing one more show. Others claim the headless ghost would spook visitors at the Trinity Church Parish, hoping to scare the gamblers and alcoholics into shaping up and not ending up like him. After all, there does seem to be some layer of mystical protection over the building itself, as it's withstood the Great Fire of New York in 1776 that burned down 25% of the city, as well as the collapse of the Twin Towers during the attacks on the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001. The 9/11 tragedy was especially destructive across the financial district where the chapel faced, but the sycamore tree sitting above the graveyard is said to have protected the building from falling debris, and maybe with the assistance of protective spirits wanting to shield their history at St. Paul's. In the end, it's a nice thought to think George Frederick Cook is haunting St. Paul's Chapel in the name of good. But in reality, the erratic, bumbling gambler is probably just tormenting tourists for the fun of it, along with the other spirits who linger in the graveyard. Lefferts Laidlaw House. Another mystery-soaked ghost story originates from the early onset of the Gilded Age at a small historic villa in Brooklyn, New York. Now known as the Lefferts Laidlaw House, the temple-fronted Greek Revival two-story home was built in 1840 by Brooklyn merchant Rem Lefferts and his brother-in-law John Laidlaw in 136 Clinton Avenue. They passed the house along to Rem's older brother, who raised his family for 3 years before selling the villa to his sister, Sarah Millard. Over the next few years, Sarah and her husband, A. Orville Millard, tended to their 5 young children before Sarah died in 1849, just after giving birth to their 6th child. It was the only recorded death to occur in the home before A. Orville sold the home in 1854, which started a string of sell-offs and revolving ownerships over the next 24 years. It wasn't until 1874 when the true chicanery began. By that time, the Lefferts Laidlaw house belonged to Edward F. Smith, who was a happy resident until mid-December when the doorbell rang one night unforeseen. Smith, a bachelor, expecting no visitors, checked the front porch but found no one awaiting him outside. Thinking it was nothing more than a harmless prank, Smith went to bed without giving it much thought. That was until he awoke in the middle of the night to more ringing, followed by a harsh banging on the back door, as if someone was pleading to enter. Again, Smith went downstairs to inspect the premises, but found no source for either the ringing or the knocking. These horrible noises continued on a nightly basis, all the way through the holidays. To try and catch the instigator, Smith elicited the help from family and close friends to stand guard overnight in and around the house, watching for any shadowy figures or suspicious passerby circling Clinton Avenue. Despite the nightly watch shifts, the rings and bangs persisted. Running out of options, Smith turned into a private investigator, laying down a comb of ash and flour around the pathways on his property, leading up to and surrounding the front and back door. Nevertheless, the noises stayed true, and every morning Smith would wake up and find the ash-flour mixture undisturbed, sans footprints or any other evidence that someone or something had stood outside the home. Determined to solve the mind-numbing mystery once and for all, Smith finally went to the New York Police Department to file an official complaint. At first, the authorities didn't believe Smith and brushed him off, until his never-ending pleas for help convinced them that something may be afoot. The local precinct captain, along with one of his most trusted detectives, staked out the Lefferts Laidlaw house. Throughout the night, the two officers heard both the ringing and violent banging, but couldn't find the source either. Bewildered and disturbed, they went back for a second night with additional officers to back up their observations. This time, instead of noises, an actual brick was thrown through a window in the dining room. The only place it could have come from was a pathway right outside the home, but none of the NYPD officers stationed outside saw anything remotely close to a brick being thrown, much less a person. In the end, not even the authorities could explain it. In the weeks that followed, the home at 136 Clinton Avenue became the talk of the neighborhood. Police carried out searches inside the house, looking for trick wires or any secret passages that could have allowed for a disguised prankster to carry out his misdoings, but nothing of the sort was ever found. Eventually, the noises stopped, and Smith moved out of the villa. But in interviews with reporters weeks after the initial incident, Smith admitted he had given up hope of ever solving the ordeal. Originally, he was careful to blame anything of a supernatural origin, but eventually conceded that the prankster was so torturous and tormenting, he figured it could have been Satan himself, if not at least one of his demonic minions. Throughout the years since Smith abandoned the two-story House of Horror Sounds, many people have purchased and sold the property without ever claiming to have heard such doorbell ringing or dastardly knocking. Ghost hunters and psychics have explored the 180-year-old residence, with seances held on the sidewalks outside, but nothing conclusive was ever exposed. Some believe Smith paid off his family and the local police for his 15 minutes of fame. Others believe he was being haunted by the spirit of Sarah Millard, angry at her family for abandoning her after her death. The psychics were actually on the side of Smith, believing his encounters were the disturbed and unhappy spirits, poltergeist from the underworld. As of today, 136 Clinton Avenue belongs to a New York City-based fashion designer and remains out of the news cycle, but we'll keep an eye on it just in case the ringing from hell returns. The Octagon. About 7 miles north of Brooklyn, into the borough of Manhattan, another hysterical haunting started in the 19th century. On Roosevelt Island, at 888 Main Street, where the infamous octagon became the entrance to an actual hell on earth, no doorbells needed. The octagon was constructed in 1834 to serve as the entrance for what was inappropriately named the New York City Lunatic Asylum, and eventually became the New York City Mental Health Hospital. It immediately gravitated the attention of New Yorkers with its unique octagonal shape and five-story rotunda, designed by brilliant architect Alexander Jackson Davis, who built some of the most notable structures in the city. For the hospital itself, it was built throughout the 1830s on a 15-acre stretch of land on Roosevelt Island, aimed to help shelter mentally unwell patients at a more discreet and secluded location in the metropolitan area. It opened in 1841 and originally held 800 patients at capacity, running operations on a normal basis. This amicable trend did not last, however, as the hospital eventually began admitting more patients than the building could hold, and the number more than doubled to 1,700 patients after a few years. It didn't take long for the word to spread like wildfire across New York City that the Institute on Roosevelt Island was mistreating their patients. In 1887, investigative journalist Elizabeth Cochran Seaman, known by her pen name as Nellie Bly, entered the hospital undercover, disguised as a patient, to document the living horrors people gossiped about around Manhattan. What she found was beyond disturbing, and ended up writing a novel about her experiences called 10 Days in a Madhouse, published later that year. Checking into the woman's lunatic asylum boarding house on the hospital grounds, Nellie was able to explore all facets of the institution. With the nurses believing her return to a normal behavior was a subset of her mental illness, nobody suspected a thing. Nellie was able to log the terrifying conditions, such as the spoiled and rotten food the nurses were giving to the patients, and how the caretakers would beat the patients who refused to be quiet, even if they were unable to control their voices. Nellie also talked about the true lack of space the patients endured. For most of the day, patients sat on incredibly hard and uncomfortable benches in drafty areas of the hospital, where cold winds would bite the skin of patients under their tattered garments. The patients deemed violent by staff would be tied together by rope, forcing them into confined spaces. And worst of all, everyone was constantly exposed to waste and feces lying around, covered with rats and other vermin infestations. But the horrors didn't end there. The water and bathing situations at the hospital were born from pure evil. The water was naturally dirty and was used directly as both drinking water and bathing water. When patients had to take baths, the nurses would pour ice-cold water over their heads, shocking their systems and then violently scrubbing them with rough sponges and washcloths. The nurses wouldn't even change out the water used to bathe the patients, recycling horribly dirty water and leaving the bathtubs unscrubbed and covered with dirt and grime. The towels were also reused, meaning physically healthy patients were rubbing their body with towels used by patients who had open wounds, sores, and other potential bacteria. These disgusting practices undoubtedly led to illness and death, leaving tortured souls to die in the most inhumane ways possible. One of the most mind-numbing facts of Nellie's investigation is that some of the women she interviewed whilst undercover appeared quite sane, and Nellie believed some of the people kept within the walls of the octagon were healed or no longer in need of asylum. The hospital was literally keeping people held hostage, imprisoned against their will, and claiming actions of normalcy were just symptoms of a deeper, darker mental illness. Eventually, the hospital was deemed unsuitable for patients and it closed much too late in 1955. The octagon stayed abandoned until June 2006, when it was restored as a lobby/foyer area for some newly built apartment complexes where the hospital once stood. The fact that the octagon had survived so many years was a miracle in and of itself. Making it through multiple fires and the general decay of Roosevelt Island weather, still kept prisoner at the octagon are many of the souls left to rest, in disturbed fashion, staying on Roosevelt Island as ghosts who can't quite leave the earthly realm. While there hasn't been many modern-day reports of spiritual sightings at the Octagon by current tenants, occasional ghost stories do come up when the island is discussed. One such narrative is that the residents of the Octagon notice their pet dogs will stare at empty spaces and bark uncontrollably, even when no one is around, as if keeping poltergeists and other invisible ghouls at bay. Others have mentioned that random noises can be heard in the Octagon's hallways at night, as if people are falling out of bed and thumping on the ceiling. Some visitors have even gone on to say that even if there are no ghosts appearing from the air, the Octagon does give off an incredibly eerie feeling, making those who walk around its five-story rotunda stew in intense sadness, feeling the fear and pain those patients endured back in its heyday as a mental institute. Even if the Octagon carries on as a relatively normal place these days, it will always be known for harboring torture and suffering. The hit show American Horror Story turned their second season into a soft retelling of Nellie Bly's novel, with American Horror Story Asylum giving us the best look into what experiences people underwent in the Octagon in the 1880s, and the type of evil and demonic energy it left behind. The Dakota. New York City is filled with landmarks left and right, more so than any other major metropolitan area across the United States. Many of those famous sightseeing locations are living quarters and private residences housing the countless famous figures who have called the Big Apple their home at one time or another over the past 300 years. A lot of these projects were completed in the 19th century, but the 20th century was where most of the malevolent foul play began, and the ghost sightings took off. The most iconic of all these jinxed living quarters might be the Dakota, also known as the Dakota Apartments, a hotspot for haunts and other paranormal activity since its grand opening. The Dakota's construction broke ground in 1880 and wrapped up in 1884. The architecture, designed by famous hotel creative Henry Janeway Hardenberg, who also designed the Plaza and Waldorf Astoria hotels. It's located at 1 West 72nd Street at the corner of 72nd and Central Park West in the Upper West Side of Manhattan. The namesake came from the unsurprisingly uninhabited area of which the apartment complex was built, mirroring the Dakota territory of the same era. It wouldn't take long for the Dakota to attract its fair share of residents, however, and when the turn of the century came, the Upper West Side was full of colorful characters and lively personalities that made New York City the melting pot it was and continues to be. Some of those famous faces that called the Dakota Apartments home range from Hollywood's golden age actress, Lauren Bacall, to superstar singer and actress Judy Garland, to a couple of football powerhouse names like John Madden and Joe Namath. The most famous of all, though, were legendary musicians John Lennon and Yoko Ono, the former a member of the Beatles and the latter an artist and activist. The couple met in 1966, and after Lennon left the Beatles to focus on his independent career, the two moved to New York City in 1973, picking the Dakota due to its prime location near Central Park and top-notch security system in place. In the end, it was a lack of security that led to Lennon's unfortunate murder. 7 years later, on December 8, 1980, John Lennon arrived back at home in front of the Dakota with his wife, Yoko Ono. That's around 10:50 p.m. as they walked through the famous archway associated with the apartment complex. A man by the name of Mark David Chapman leapt forward after staking out the building all day and shot Lennon 4 times with a .22 revolver, twice in the back and shoulder. Lennon was pronounced dead 25 minutes later at Roosevelt Hospital, while Chapman sat outside of the Dakota reading The Catcher in the Rye, his main inspiration for the assassination, until his arrest. If the events of Lennon's murder aren't creepy enough, it only gets worse from there. In the 40-plus years since his death, underneath the archway, tenants old and new have discussed sightings of John Lennon's ghost in the Dakota. There have also been occasions of singing and music heard from within the walls of the apartment building. Thought to be the spirit of Lennon creating art even after passing, Lennon's widow, Yoko Ono, herself has claimed to see the ghost of her late husband roaming the hallways of the Dakota too. In a bizarre twist, Ono has also told reporters that even before Lennon was killed, he had his own paranormal encounter at the Dakota Apartments, telling his wife once in the late 1970s that he'd seen a crying woman walking about the corridors at night, like an apparition. Because the crying woman was only ever reportedly seen by John Lennon himself, many wonder if she had appeared as an omen, attempting to alert Lennon of the impending doom at the archways. Others think she was simply a spirit mourning John Lennon's fate, as he was a symbol of inspiration, peace and love to millions of people around the world. While the assassination of John Lennon is the most infamous event to occur at the Dakota, it isn't the only one saturated with evil. The 1968 horror film Rosemary's Baby used the apartment's exterior to the living quarters in the story's central location. For those unfamiliar with the plotline, Rosemary's Baby follows a couple who move into a lavish New York apartment known for its history with the occult and witchcraft. The main character, Rosemary Woodhouse, has a dream that she is impregnated by Satan, and soon finds out that she is pregnant a few months later. Rosemary and her husband, Guy, are soon befriended by their neighbors at the complex, who eventually kidnap Rosemary's baby to use in their satanic coven's rituals. While there is no connection between the apartment in the movie and the real-life Dakota, viewers have wondered if the original book's writer, Ira Levin, gained inspiration from the characters he encountered at the Dakota, and wonder if there was a certain degree of witchcraft occurring in the Dakota's many rooms. Upon further research, there isn't much evidence of any satanic happenings in the Dakota. However, there have been a couple of notorious ghost sightings. One is of a young girl running around in late 19th century clothing, teasing the tenants of the building with a bubbly, friendly demeanor. Another sighting is of a more disturbing nature, with residents sometimes seeing an adult male lurking in the shadows, featuring the face of a young boy despite his older physique. It's possible these spirits are the lingering souls of former tenants at 1 West 72nd Street, left to keep the history of the Dakota alive and its past, present, and future tenants on their toes. The Merchant's House Museum. One of the more unexplored and benevolent ghosts of New York City resides at 29 East 4th Street, southeast of Washington Square Park, presently known as the Merchant's House Museum. It was purchased in 1835 by Seabury Treadwell, a recent hardware merchant retiree, who had reaped the rewards of a successful business and wanted a home of comfort for his wife Eliza and 7 children. In 1840, the Treadwell couple gave birth to an 8th child, this time a baby girl they named Gertrude. Gertrude was raised under a strict household, and as a young woman was denied the chance to marry the love of her life by her father, Seabury. Thus, Gertrude lived the rest of her life by her lonesome, filled with disdain and chagrin at the rest of her family. By 1909, all of the living Treadwells had left 29 East 4th Street except Gertrude, who remained disgruntled until her death in 1933, at the age of 93, passing away in the same bed she was born in. It only took a few years after her demise for the city of New York to transform the estate into a museum, dedicated to keeping both the exterior and the interior of the house true to its 19th century architecture and decor. It's a project still available for tourists to experience in the present day, enduring decades of stories that while the Treadwells' physical beings left the home, their spirits never did. The most popular ghost sighting is of the unlucky lady herself, Gertrude, who has been spotted running around the manor in various stages of her life, as a young girl brimming with innocence, to a haughty young adult, broken over her father's conservatorship, to an elderly old woman with empty, melancholic eyes wearing a long brown dress. This version of Gertrude was the first sighting as documented by a board member of the museum, who stated that in the late 1930s, a group of kids were hanging around the front steps and fire escapes to cool off from the especially hot summer day, when the front door swung open and the ghost of Gertrude ran out to shoo the children away. A caretaker who looked after the museum in the 1950s also felt an ethereal presence, stating she'd often find the silk tassels wrapped around curtains dancing in the air, as if an invisible presence was twirling them aimlessly. She also described a tapping sound heard throughout the manor on quiet days, as if someone was attempting to communicate with telegraphic code. Some wonder if this was Gertrude attempting to communicate with the real world from her spiritual realm. However, the messages were never decoded, even after a young couple heard the same knocking sounds, after taking over caretaker duties in the 1960s. The most recent sighting came from a museum docent who was leading a tour before opening the servants' chambers and finding a woman who appeared to be from a different era in time. Her clothes matched more of a 19th century style and her demeanor was not of modern day. The docent and the strange lady made eye contact and both jumped at the surprise, but neither were questioned further and the 19th century woman wasn't spotted again. It's believed that this specific sighting was of another Treadwell family member, and there have been plenty of other unverified reports, stating the entire family has spirits filling the halls of 29 East 4th Street. The thing that has remained true amidst it all, though, is the mild and non-harmful manner in which these ghosts appear. They don't seem to be pushing visitors away from the museum, rather simply coexisting in the space they grew up in. As for Gertrude, it appears as if she's content roaming the corridors of the only place she ever knew for all of eternity, only scaring passing children from time to time when she needs a break from her melancholic brooding. New York City is a place that dates back almost 400 years, with many of its iconic locations and historical landmarks built prior to the 20th century. Its most legendary folklore originates to colonial times, and the ghosts of yesteryear truly are from a time and place long, long ago. However, there are a couple of locations in the Big Apple that have seen new haunts arise in the last 50 years, or are at least currently open to explorers and amateur ghost hunters alike in the modern age. On October 12, 1978, the Hotel Chelsea saw its most gruesome incident in its 94-year history, when Nancy Spungen was found stabbed to death on her bathroom floor. Hotel Chelsea, found at 222 West 23rd Street in Manhattan, was a hotspot for actors and musicians to reside whilst working in the entertainment capital of the world. Artists such as Bob Dylan, Mark Twain, Stanley Kubrick, and Cher all called the building home at one point in their careers. And Nancy and her husband, Sid Vicious, the bassist for the rock band The Sex Pistols, were amongst them. Sid was arrested for a murder and gave conflicting interviews afterwards, but died 1 year later from a drug overdose. It was speculated that Sid and Nancy had a suicide pact, as flaunted by Sid's mother, but Nancy's murder was never actually solved, and the NYPD closed the case after Sid's death. It's rumored that in the 43 years since that fateful night, the ghosts of both Nancy and Sid can be seen together, spooking innocent residents and appearing in shadowy corners of the Hotel Chelsea. Another haunted locale popular amongst 21st century residents of New York City is the Woodlawn Cemetery, located at Webster Avenue and East 233rd Street in the Bronx. Open to the public and a popular tourist spot for ghost tours, Woodlawn Cemetery has been around since the Civil War in 1863. And is the resting spot for plenty of famous people, including Miles Davis, Herman Melville, Dorothy Parker, and none other than Nellie Bly herself, the journalist who exposed the Octagon's infamous mental institute. Some of the popular ghost sightings around Woodlawn include a crazed older gentleman who holds a flashlight and screams at nothing, a young boy and his dog who died on his grave after he froze in a nearby canal, and a young blonde lady who sits on a stone in the cemetery, whilst a bright blue light emanates around her apparition. Woodlawn is also host to many victims of the Titanic, whose bodies were brought back to New York in 1912. The cemetery never fails to make the unsuspecting passerby scream out of fright, making it one of the spookiest star-studded spots in all of New York City's haunted underground. Without doubt, the Big Apple's rich history and massive population has lent a hand to countless ghost stories across centuries of horror and mayhem. It would be impossible to list them all, and many of them are lost to Father Time. However, because of the city's cultural significance, many of them have been preserved, and not just by word. It truly is a magnificent experience to visit New York City and discover all of its supernatural lore, even if you don't capture the paranormal activity on camera. It adds so much intrigue to a metropolis already bursting with it, and there's no signs of it slowing down. So even if you've never been to one of Manhattan's infinite haunted mansions, or one of the creepy residents lining the brownstones of Brooklyn, one thing is for sure, the ghosts of New York City are just as alive as ever, playing in the shadows and giving credence to the name, the city that never sleeps.